Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Welcome to Red Leg Nation Radio, your home for discussion and analysis of Cincinnati Reds baseball all year long. Now here's your host, Chad Dotson.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Red Leg Nation Radio, episode number 201 of the podcast. I'm Chad Dotson. With me again this week, as he has been, I think, probably more often than anyone else on this illustrious podcast, my good buddy and yours, Bill Lack. How are you today, Bill?
I'm good. Better known as the man that has nothing better to do. That's why Chad knows I'm always available. That's why I'm on here so often.
See, there's value in terms of a podcast host and having nothing else to do. That's fantastic.
Well, you know, I'm easily to be. It's easy to be talk me into these things.
Yeah, well, I know that's certainly my favorite thing about you.
Because God knows you could find somebody better to hang out with than me.
Well, I'm not going to say that, but Bill and I've been talking lately, and we thought, hey, let's do this for the podcast. You may know. If you don't know, I don't know where you've been, because that's all I've been talking about for the last little bit, that my buddy Chris Garber and I wrote a book called The Big 50, The Men and Moments That Made the Cincinnati Reds. It's out now. The 50 biggest moments that really made the Reds the Reds is the way we put it. And I'm really proud of the product. We've been really excited for a year now, really, to get the book into the hands of the public and let people let us hear what they think about it. And if you haven't bought it yet, or you haven't read it yet, you know, you can still listen here, and I hope you will. If you don't have any interest in buying the book, I think, and you're just a Reds fan, I think you'll be interested in this conversation we're getting ready to have, because it's about some fun moments in Reds history. And I think it'll be a nice little romp through the long and illustrious, again, I use that word, history of the Cincinnati Reds. Now, Bill, I just, first of all, you actually read the book, and you know, to me, that's just, I can't believe it. He actually read it. What do you think?
Well, I think, I don't know whether you're excited that I read it or that I can read.
Well, you know, take it however you want.
You know, we're not all Georgetown law, you know, graduates.
I assume you can read.
Some of us, you know, barely got out of college, you know.
All right, but okay, we've established you can read.
Yeah. Anyway. You know, like I said, I've known it, you know, for a while that that Chad and Chris were doing this, and I was excited to get my hands on a copy, and I was very honored to be mentioned in the acknowledgments in the back.
We did mention you, didn't we?
Yep, from the old Cincinnati Reds listserv list, for those of you that have been around with us for a long, long time. And I guess I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I think it ranks up there with what Greg, this kind of stuff that Greg Rhodes puts out.
Hey, listen, you're just saying that because that's what I want to hear.
No, I'm not. You know better than that.
You've never done that in the...
No, you, like I said, you know better than that.
We've known each other for probably, gosh, it's been over 20 years anyway, so...
20 years, yeah. And the next time we agree will probably be the first time we agree.
probably, but that's all right.
But... I was very excited to get a hold of this thing, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But so let's talk about that for a little bit. I was looking around and looking at Amazon, and I saw that there are a lot of these, the big 50s for different teams.
Yeah.
I saw some other baseball ones. There's one for the Eagles. I think there's one for the Boston Bruins.
It's a series that Triumph Books has put out, and, you know, we actually had a little bit of a different angle on the book we proposed to them, and they thought, boy, you know, if you just tweak that a little bit, it fits in perfect with this Big 50 series. And we said, yeah, let's do it. And
so did you approach them, or did they approach you?
Well, the truth of the matter is we approached them about our other book concept first, and some things happened. We started talking with a different publisher. Things happened with that publisher, and this Big 50 was actually supposed to be written by someone else. Originally, they had some issue with it, and they came back to us and said, hey, your concept's pretty close. Can you tweak it? And we'd love for you guys to put this book together for us. So we contacted them first. They sort of put us off a little bit, and they said, wait a minute, let's do this. And we jumped right into it.
Do you want to talk about your other concept, or is that something you're kind of hiding and you might percolate and use later?
I don't think we're going to use it later. It was sort of the 50 greatest games in Red's history. And a lot of the chapters that we've been working on for that book just fit perfectly with this one. And that was actually a concept we'd had years ago, and we really didn't pursue it that much other than just talking between ourselves and refining the concept a little bit. We didn't really pitch it out much. Until just a couple years ago, we thought, you know what, let's send that thing back out again and just see. And at this point, you know, publishers were a lot more receptive to us because, you know, Red Leg Nation's been around now for 13 years, over 13 years. And so, you know.
Well, and you're writing for, you know, ESPN a little bit and Cincinnati Magazine, I think. So you kind of got some writing chops.
Well, I don't know if I've got any chops, but certainly I was a little more well-known, I guess, in that community, and so had a little bit better case to make that we had a platform to sell a book and that we had the chops to write the book.
So tell us about the process of how you guys did this. Did you figure out the 50 and then research, or did you start researching and figuring out there was enough information for them to, you know, to give you a section?
Well, the truth of the matter is it took a long process of Chris and I going back and forth, and there were probably, actually, I'm not sure how many. I couldn't even guess how many potential topics there were for.
That was my next question. How many men and moments that you researched got left on the cutting room floor?
There were probably between 5 and 10 that were seriously in the mix to make the top 50, and there were actually at least 2 chapters that were actually fully written that ended up getting cut. So
what was 51?
51, well, it's hard to say because we actually had a chapter on a guy named Walker Cooper who had the greatest batting performance in Reds history. And just a crazy game, 12 RBIs, I think.
And I've never even heard that name.
Yeah, well, you're going to read that chapter. We're going to put it on Red Leg Nation, or it'll be at Cincinnati Magazine or somewhere. We're going to end up publishing that chapter because it's a fun chapter. But when Scooter Jeanette had his big day last year, we decided to remove the Walker Cooper chapter and put in the Scooter chapter as the greatest performance.
Now substituting for...
Yes. So that was actually probably 51, I guess. But, you know, there are so many things that have happened in this. You know, we wanted to do something with the first TV game and first night game, and we couldn't get both of those in there. And so there were a lot of concepts, and it took a while for us to sort of refine them and then get them in the order that we felt like we wanted. You know, Eric Davis.
Now, I want to ask you about that. So, you know, am I understanding this correctly, that the greatest moment of the Big 50 was Game 6 of the 75 World Series?
A game they lost, yes.
Yeah.
We went round and round on that, but, you know, it's just, it's by many people's accounts, the greatest game in the history of baseball. And it was sort of a time when baseball was on its heels a little bit. And that series helped bring it back. And it was really just a way for us to get into the Big Red Machine. And that was a game that we felt like would be the best introduction to who this Big Red Machine team was. And of course, you have to deal with that. A Big Red Machine moment has to be number one on the list. And so so we decided to go with that one. And because there was so much drama around it, and we felt like we could tell that story a little bit differently than it had been told before, which was the goal for every single chapter, was to tell these stories in a way that they hadn't been told before. And so, yeah, we went with a game that the team lost as the biggest moment in Reds history.
How did you and Chris come up with these? I mean, you know, I know there's no way that you guys agreed on all 50.
Well, we came pretty close to agreeing. I mean, almost all of them. When it came down to it, we just debated, you know. There was another chapter, I think.
Oh, boy, two lawyers.
Right. But
did you have a mediator? Did you have a mediator to sit in and...
No, what it came down to was we just sort of gave a little bit on each side. You know, hey, I'd really like to write this chapter, so let me do this one. And he wants this other one that I didn't really, you know, that I was maybe on the edge for me. And so we just, we gave and gave, and eventually we negotiated it down to 50. And I think we're both, Chris will tell you as well, very happy with the 50 that we chose.
I guess that, yeah, that was another question I was going to ask, how you guys actually did the writing. So you guys split them up.
We did. We each wrote 25 of the chapters. And the way we did it really was we just, or first of all, is there something you really want to write about? We had a spreadsheet on Google Documents. We had a spreadsheet of every chapter, and we just, hey, here's one I'm going to go ahead and claim because I want to write it right now, research it and write it. And then we just went back and forth claiming them. And then when it got down to the last few, we literally had sort of a draft for the last probably 10 chapters. I'm going to pick this one, and Chris is going to pick this one, and we just went back and forth as to which chapters we wanted to write to get it finished. But we started out with, well, what most interests you, or what do you want to learn about, or what do you want to research? All the 1990 Reds chapters went with one author, and all the Big Red Machine chapters went with another author. So to make it easier to do the research.
We weren't duplicating the process.
Exactly. But we had a huge Google folder, in a Google Documents folder with all the research and everything and that both of us had access to. And we'd go in there sometimes when we were revising the book, and you would not believe how many revisions this book went through till we got it to just where we wanted it. We would actually be in real time watching each other edit and making suggestions, and it was actually a really fun collaborative process.
And you guys are still speaking?
We are, as a matter of fact, more than ever. He's probably sick of me at this point.
Was there anything that it just killed you to leave out?
Well, there was a chapter in the original book concept that just didn't fit in this, but I had so much fun researching it. And I'm not going to give too much away about it, except because I do think that we're going to be able to publish this somewhere, this particular chapter as a magazine piece. But it was a chapter on, before we were talking about the 50 greatest games, this is one where Babe Ruth came to Cincinnati, and nobody ever hit a ball over the center field wall at it was Redland Field at the time, became Crosley Field. And he came in and hit 3 home runs, and it was just like this huge introduction to the world for Babe Ruth in an exhibition game. But what was interesting about it was there was a bet made by a couple guys at a bar about the about whether he could hit one out, because nobody thought he could. And one guy said, yes, he can. And when this one guy won the bet, the other guy was so mad that he actually shot him. And there was this big, it was a murder and a big investigation and a manhunt. And there's this whole secondary story around that game that I thought was so much fun to research and write. And it just didn't fit in this book. But that's the one that really killed me the most to leave out.
All right.
But we'll get that one. You'll read that one at some point.
Okay. excuse me. How did you guys decide the order? Did you vote? Did you...
Sort of similar to how we picked them, we just came to a consensus on it, and we really didn't argue that much. I think Chris first gave a first pass at, hey, here's a suggested order, and then I went back through and said, hey, well, maybe we should move this one up, and here's why, and then maybe we should move this one down, and we just went back and forth a little bit. Mostly it's in the order Chris picked originally, but, you know, we made tweaks all along the way, even up to the very end in terms of the order of the chapters.
Is there anything or person that you omitted that you and I've got a small list here that with people that kind of surprised me that aren't hardly in there or aren't in here at all. There's no section on Frank Robinson, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah. We had to try to figure out how to get Frank Robinson in, and he takes up significant portions of a couple of different chapters.
Right.
The 1961 Reds.
Yep.
Was intended to, and we actually had a really good sort of sidebar that ended up having to get cut about Frank Robinson, and we tried to add him in at different places. Probably, in retrospect, that's probably one that deserved his own chapter, but we got into so much of his stuff in these other chapters, we weren't able to squeeze him in. And but I think there's plenty of Frank Robinson's all over this book.
I'm not disagreeing. You know, the one that didn't get a whole lot of mention that I think could have been brought in a couple of different ways is Ted Kluszewski. Not only was, you know, I mean, he's mentioned a couple of times, but, you know, not only was he a Red Star in the 50s, he was the hitting coach of the Big Red Machine.
True, true. And Kluszewski was one of the chapters, one of the potential chapters that ended up getting left out. It was really hard. It was really hard for us to decide how to weigh.
I'm not picking a nit here.
I'm happy to talk about it. It was hard for us to decide how to weigh men versus moments. And we get these certain moments, these events in Reds history that have to be in there. But we also wanted to highlight the most important people as well. And a guy like Ted Kluszewski, he was on the list. He didn't quite make it. When we had those guys like that, we tried to make sure that we, you know, added some information about them here or there so that they were there. The Reds weren't particularly – there was no really memorable team or event during Kluszewski's career necessarily.
No, there was the 56 Reds.
Right, but when you were, 40 years old?
I was only 22 then.
But that's probably not going to be one of your biggest moments in history,
right,
that team.
I agree. They didn't win anything.
Kluszewski's certainly one of the most memorable personalities, and that went a long way. We made some decisions, and he barely missed the cut, but I think that's when we brought the big 60, he's one definitely in there, maybe even the big 55.
Were there some guys that might have been included, but you couldn't find enough information on?
Not really. A guy that I really wanted to include more than we did, because we wanted to – the whole idea behind the book, let me just say this first, is we wanted it to read so that a casual fan could pick it up and read it and, you know, read a chapter here and there and really learn about the Reds. But we didn't want it to be a textbook. We also tried really hard, and I'm really eager to find out what people think about this, and we've got some good feedback on this point. If you did know a lot about the Reds already, we wanted to make sure every chapter had something in there that you didn't really know, or that you didn't realize, or the first time you'd heard it. But we wanted to provide value for the casual fan and the hardcore fan. And one guy he didn't make the cut, but one guy I really wanted to write about was Vada Pinson, who
he was on my list. Yep,
great career, sort of underknown, not unknown, but underknown among Reds fans, and he's a guy that I don't want Reds fans to forget, I guess. And so,
there was a period of time, and I don't know that it's true anymore. Time has passed, but there was a period of time where a lot of people said he was the best player not in the Hall of Fame.
Sure. I don't think that's true now necessarily, but I mean, just a great, great, great player, probably just shy of Hall of Fame worthy. But I mean, that's not really a criticism, you know, to say that he was just really, really good. And he was from his rookie season on. And we thought about, you know, trying to do something with Frank and Vada Pinson,
and Vada,
Frank Robinson,
yeah,
because they were teammates, they were best friends. And that was one of the concepts that ended up having to be sort of shoved in different places. But that's a guy that I really would have liked to have explored a little more. Maybe I can in another project someday.
And Jim Maloney isn't front and center in the book. And again, I'm showing my age a little bit, but that's another one that kind of surprised me.
Yeah. And that's a guy that, you know, not a Hall of Famer. He's a Reds Hall of Famer. Great career and really sort of dominant at a time. We just couldn't find a way to sneak him in other than just in terms of talking about him in a couple of chapters. But yeah, absolutely. He was in one of the ones. Matter of fact, I think he might have been in one of the original iterations of the first of the 50 chapters and ended up having to get bumped down now that I think about it.
And I was just looking at, you know, old Reds, guys like Bid McPhee and Noodles Hahn, Heinie Groh.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much information there would be out there for them.
It's a little hard. It was easier for more recent guys, and even guys from the 50s onward, because the newspaper coverage was pretty good and sort of flowery coverage.
Yeah.
And a lot of interesting anecdotes. When you started getting back into, I found this out when I was not just researching the 1919 championship res, but also back to the 1869, it's just really hard to... 1919 wasn't as bad because that was the Black Sox World Series, and so there was a lot of coverage since then, a lot of research done on that. But the further you go back, it is. We wanted to provide a little bit of color, and we wanted to provide a little bit of a sense of what it would be like to be there. And some of those, you know, Ed Rausch is given some high praise in the 1919 Reds chapter, mm-hmm. but in terms of being able to justify a full chapter, one of the greatest Reds of all time, certainly a Hall of Famer, but, you know, we couldn't do with Ed Rausch chapter like I would hope we'd be able to do. Like, you know, we had a guy like Johnny Cueto in there who a lot of guys wouldn't necessarily think.
And Billy Bates.
Well, Billy Bates. Yes, Billy Bates. I mean, that was one of the moments. He wasn't one of the men necessarily, but
right.
He was the man at the center of one of the biggest moments. That was one that almost got cut. I think maybe that's one that I took a stand. I really think we need to have Billy Bates in here, for better or worse. So
I like the fact that you guys. I mean, most of these are positive moments for the Reds. You know, there's losing the 73 playoffs. Yeah. There's losing the 72 World Series, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But most of them are positives. And it was that a consensus thought?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, you know, you had to have some of the – I mean, 75, Game 6, that was a disappointment to lose that one. It ended up being a good memory.
Yeah, but if you know, but when you know that they win the next day, yeah, it, right. You know.
But
unless you're Ron Howard doing Apollo 13, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to have a sense of suspense when you know what's going to happen.
That's true. That's true. And you know, in terms of picking out positive moments or optimistic moments or fun moments, well, you know, those are the moments that made the Reds what we think of today. By and large, there are some disappointments. That we kind of glossed over the 1961 World Series that they lost after that such an incredible season, because I wanted to focus on just an amazing season. Chris and I both wanted to focus on an amazing season and what it was like to be a fan of a team, you know, that turned around in one year like that. And so and try to put it in the context of the coming Big Red Machine. So
what's your favorite one?
My favorite chapter. Probably the chapter on Yul Blackwell, the whip.
It's funny. I've got that one in my notes because I knew about Yul Blackwell, but I didn't know that he was as dominating as you guys talk about in the book.
That's funny. You know, this morning I was actually talking with Ken Brew on 700 WLW, and that's the way I put it to him. That what was most interesting to me in doing the research for that chapter when Chris and I were researching it. Was how everyone else in the league just thought he was the greatest pitcher on earth. I mean, he was widely considered to be, you know, like we think of Clayton Kershaw today. And he made six straight All-Star teams. I mean, he was dominant. But I'm not sure a lot of Reds fans, because he pitched in the 40s, really understand that. You know, he was just overpowering. He had that crazy windup. That's why they called him the Whip. And as we were researching, we kept finding. My favorite part about doing the research for that one is, as Chris and I were researching it, we kept coming up with these different descriptions of him where opponents or sports writers or his teammates had these nicknames for him. And you know, we know the Whip was his nickname, but we probably came up with 20 other names that he was called in different newspapers around the country. A fly rod with ears, Cincinnati's thin man. Yeah. My favorite one was, if I can remember it, it was in the New York World Telegram. Described his Blackwell's appearance was described as that of a Picasso impression of an octopus in labor. I mean, it was like everyone's trying to one-up each other with their descriptions of him. But ultimately,
I don't even know what that means.
I don't either, but you can just imagine what he looked like. That seemed to be something that they had fun doing in the first coming up with names. So that was one of the more interesting chapters, because it was a guy that I knew was a great player and a special player in Reds history. But I'm as, you know, as big a fan as anyone. I didn't realize he was so dominant until really getting into it. And he really was the greatest pitcher on earth for a while. And I say on earth because he went into the army, and there were stories told all around Europe about this pitcher that they've got playing baseball for his army unit. So that was a fun chapter.
I have to admit my favorite was probably the Joe Morgan chapter.
Yeah.
I've said this on our podcast many times, is 75 and 76, he was the best player I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, and nobody else even is even close to being able to do all the things that Jim Morgan was able to do. Just a complete baseball player.
He really was. And not just a complete baseball player, a guy that could do everything on the field. But, I mean, he just some of our view of him is skewed by his broadcasting career, maybe, and the things he's said some crazy things occasionally. But we named that chapter Baseball Genius because he really was. I mean, he thought on a different level than everybody else when he was playing. And, we sort of paired that chapter a couple chapters later with the Joey Votto chapter. And just to look at the way Votto looks at the game differently than everyone else. And we primed that with Joe Morgan, who just was operating on a different level mentally in the way, in terms of the way he was thinking of the game. But then also he could just do things that nobody else could do, and he did everything well. So I was going to ask you what your favorite chapter was.
That's probably what it is. And it's funny because I was reading it, and I've read a lot of things on A Big Red Machine over the years and about Morgan and Bench and Perez and Rose and blah, blah, blah. But where you talked about here that he used to get leads so big that he could steal signs from the catcher.
Yeah.
I'd never heard that before, and I've never heard of anybody else ever doing that.
Can you imagine?
No.
I mean, it's...
But I can't honestly remember, and as we as you are so apt to put out, I am a bit older than you are. And
Not much.
I was like getting out of high school in the Big Red Machine in the mid-70s. And I can remember the feeling when Morgan got on first base, and you could feel the pitcher tighten up.
I bet.
Especially if the game was close. Now, Morgan wasn't one of those guys that stole bases, pardon me, just to steal bases. He stole bases when it was needed, and which is why he never had, 75, 80, 100 stolen bases. But he'd get out there and he'd put that one foot on the carpet, one foot in the dirt, and edge a little bit closer to trying to get both feet on the carpet. And it's almost unheard of now, but you'd see pitchers throw over 5, 6, 7, 8 times.
Yeah.
Trying to drive him back to the base. And they never got him to shorten his lead up.
Right. That's something we touched on. He was sort of somehow in control from over there.
Yeah.
You know.
The minute he got on base, he had control of what was going on in the ballgame. He put pressure on the pitcher the minute he left the on-deck circle.
Absolutely. My favorite part of that was of that chapter was when he came up with the Colt 45s, and he got injured and had to sit and watch, and he spent the time learning what do these pitchers
right.
do, and he realized that there are things he can do that he hadn't been doing, that he was capable of doing, that could change the way he played, and he sort of reinvented himself as a player up before coming to Cincinnati.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if he hadn't sat out for that whole season or most of that one season, what was it, 67 or 68?
Yeah, yeah.
Whether he would have been the same player.
Right, yeah. And because
plus the fact that he's a featured player in of one of your and my favorite baseball books.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Ball four. Those of you that have never read Ball Four, you need to read. If you're a baseball fan and you haven't read Ball Four, you're not a baseball fan.
I'm telling you, it's the second best baseball book ever, right after The Big 50, The Men and Moments That Made the Cincinnati Reds.
Uh-huh.
No, Ball 4, Bill, it's got over 2 decades ago, introduced me to that book. I had never read it before Bill recommended it, and I've read it probably 20 times since then, including most recently this past offseason. I mean, it's laugh-out-loud funny.
Yes, it is.
And it's.
I think the first time I read it, someone gave it to me in paperback when I was in junior high school.
Yeah, it's a classic. I absolutely recommend that one. So, well, I was going to ask you about to get back. Although we need to have another podcast talking about Ball Four because that book it still holds up. I couldn't believe when I read it this year how much I was still.
And people that read it will be amazed at the names that are in there that they know.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I literally this offseason when I reread it, I literally laughed out loud a number of times.
You can't help it. I mean, the silliness and pettiness and some of the things said are just hysterical.
It's fantastic. But a question I wanted to ask you, Bill, because this was really important to us, we all know about the Big Red Machine. I mean, every Cincinnati Reds fan has heard all these stories about the Big Red Machine. And of course, you remember some of the things that we wrote about in the book. Did you get a sense when you were reading these Big Red Machine chapters that were you engaged? Were you learning something, or was it presented in a way that, you know, was still engaging to someone who sort of knows these stories?
Oh, it's both. I think it was both. And I'm sitting here looking at the list of what my favorite chapters were. And the next one on my list is the 72 World or the 72 playoffs.
And that's one that almost didn't make it, but we thought, man, that's such a moment.
Right? I don't know how I couldn't make it. I mean, Johnny Bench's home run in game five was maybe the biggest home run in Reds history.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess when I say...
You talk about the Davis home run in 1990, you could, you know...
But that 72, that's not one that people would automatically think.
Right.
Is in
and it's funny because reading that, I remember the bench. I came home from school and saw the end of the game and saw the bench home run. But what I didn't remember the Grimsley performance in game four.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, and I went back and looked that up. And you and I had been talking about, another chapter, the 72 series. And you and I were talking about this online or texting about it or something. And, to this day, I still haven't forgiven Bobby Tolan
for right. Yeah, you losing said the
72 World Series. And I didn't, I was 14 at the time. I did not sleep that Sunday night when they lost game seven. I didn't sleep all night. I was so upset.
That's fantastic.
And on that, like I said, I've never forgotten Tolan. But what I remembered, and I was telling you, I thought it would happen late in the game, that Hal McCray came up as a pinch hitter and hit a ball to the wall that if it would have went out, it would have given the Reds the lead. Pardon me. But I went back and looked it up, and it turned out it happened in the fifth inning with the bases loaded. And it ended up being a sacrifice fly. And I remember him even calling him out of the tunnel. And you know, he was probably down there warming up, I would assume, or either that or he was in the bathroom. Who the hell knows? But, you know, five more feet and the Reds win the 72 World Series. You know, because, I mean, he crushed this ball. But it's funny how your memory over time changes. Because I would have bet any amount of money that happened late in the game and it happened in the fifth inning. But that was an amazing World Series. What was it? Six of the seven games were decided by one run.
Yes, yes.
You know what you didn't mention in the chapter though?
What's that?
Was Dick Williams? Not Dick Williams. Manager of the A's was. Was it Dick Williams?
Dick Williams wasn't manager those days, was he?
Anyway, we'll look up, and if you're listening, you can look it up yourself. But whoever the manager of the A's was, how he suckered Johnny Bench and humiliated Johnny Bench on national television.
It was Dick Williams.
You know what I'm talking about?
It was Dick Williams, by the way.
Was it? Okay.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
I don't think so. What are you?
The Bench comes up. And Williams comes out of the out to the mound, and I'm operating all off memory here. And Raleigh Fingers is on the mound, and it's like a 3-2 count. And he points at first base at least twice. Put him on.
Mm-hmm.
And they threw the ball right down the middle for strike three.
Oh yes, I have heard that one. Yeah.
And my guess is Johnny Bench this day still has nightmares about that.
Probably.
And that wasn't mentioned in your 72 World Series chapter.
I'm sorry we let you down, Bill.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
I know.
It was just such. It was a big moment.
Yeah, yeah.
The Bob Housen chapter I thought was really, really good. I really enjoyed it.
That was a tough one, let me tell you, because the first draft of that chapter was like 4,000 words, and we really had to cut it down. To its essence, because there was so much about the way he went about constructing. And that was the name of the chapter, The Architect of the Big Red Machine. There's so much about that chapter that I didn't know once the research was done. And you got to learn a little bit more about his thoughts. And we felt it was important to put Housen in his own chapter rather than just talking about the Big Red Machine.
I think Bob Housen should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yes. We addressed that in the book, or did that get cut out? I can't remember.
I don't remember it in the book.
Yeah.
I know when we used to do our Reds List Hall of Fame every year.
That's right, yeah.
Bob Housen never got elected to our Reds List Hall of Fame.
Really?
Nope.
How's that possible?
I don't know. I think a lot of guys, even at, you know, unless they're like my age, they know about the Big Red Machine, but they probably don't know a whole lot about Bob Housen.
Well, they will if they buy this book.
Yeah. The other thing I thought of when I was reading this is, you wonder if he'd have stayed on, whether he could have adjusted to the changes in baseball. Free agency.
Yeah. Well, he was firmly against free agency, and
they didn't sign a free agent until after he left the second time.
Yeah, yeah, and so that's a conversation that really is interesting, because he has this great reputation and it's well deserved. But would that have, you know, would he have adjusted in that era if he hadn't left before he came back? I don't know. He was pretty sort of steadfast in his opposition to the free agency system and the way to build teams. But he was
a thick head.
He was, but I tell you what, he built a pretty good team there.
Yeah, they had some pretty good players. The chapter that I don't know how to put this, surprises me that it was included, was the Shamsky chapter.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
But, you know, I knew him a little bit.
Oh, really?
I've told you this.
Mm-hmm.
In the mid 60s, my grandparents ran they were managers of an apartment complex over on the west side of Cincinnati.
Yeah.
That a lot of the Reds lived in. At that period of time, there was still a lot of racial segregation in terms of housing. So it was really the white Reds. But Shamsky lived there. Rose lived there. I've told you this story. I remember watching home movies in Pete Rose's apartment. It had to have been his second or third year in baseball.
Yeah, you have told me
that. Maloney, Darren Johnson, Shamsky, Don Pavletic, I remember. You know, I was 6-7 years old. This was, you know, big stuff to me, you know, meeting all these. So I knew Shamsky was friends with my parents. My grandparents. In fact, he got them a bat autographed by all the players of the Miracle Mets.
Is that right?
It's not, yeah.
Yeah. That was one that we went back and forth on including that chapter, but ultimately we thought, boy, that's something. I think what it came down to, that's one that maybe most people don't know.
Yep.
And so we thought, you know, again, in terms of weighing versus the ones that we do know, the ones we don't, and, you know, teaching about some things that we don't want to be forgotten about Reds history, that was one that ended up making the cut. And it's a crazy game that he had. I mean, he didn't start the game. He comes in the eighth inning, hits a home run to give the Reds an 8-7 lead, and then stays in the game. In the 10th inning, hits a home run to tie the game. And then in the 11th inning, hits another home run to tie the game. So he didn't even start. He comes in the 8th inning, he gets 3 home runs. It was just a wild game. And then
didn't play the next day.
And then didn't play and couldn't even crack the lineup the next day. I mean, it's just, I don't know. We thought that was sort of a unique moment that we wanted to include. And I'm actually glad we did, because almost everyone that I've talked to, yeah, I've done a bunch of radio interviews, almost all of them have wanted to talk about Art Shamsky. About the Art Shamsky chapter. Either they didn't know about it or had forgotten about it, or I think ultimately I'm glad we chose to include that one.
Another section that I really, really enjoyed because I was there was the night Pete came back. I was at the ballpark that night.
Yeah.
The minute it was announced, a bunch of us, I think, I don't remember, 10 or 12 of us, we were sitting in the green seats in center field. A bunch of us bought tickets and went down. I was at the game where they clinched, that where they, you know, they won the playoffs in 90 to go to the World Series. You know, the Glenn Braggs reaching over the fence, and
yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was there that night. And I was at the 73 game one of the 73 playoffs when the Reds beat Seaver with 2 home runs with a walk off by Pete, I think. Yeah. I think Bench hit the first one and Rose hit the second one. or vice versa. I can't remember now off the top of my head. I have never felt excitement in a ballpark like I did the night Pete came back. And when he had that, you know, he led off, you know, his first at bat, I think he had a triple, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't a triple. It was a, I think it was a double with an error, but he got to
third. Okay, and ended up at third base.
Yeah.
And belly flopped into third, and that, I thought that place was coming down.
Yeah, oh yeah. You know, that chapter and the 4192 chapter were things that people sort of know about. They remember. And it sort of highlights what we tried to do with the book. The 4192 chapter, Pete's 4,192nd hit, we used a little bit of a different narrative structure to try to tell that story in a different way. With the night that Pete came back, what we really wanted to do more than anything was try to put you in the ballpark. Try to, and if you go back and look at it, and for those of you that read it, you'll notice that we're trying to talk about what it was like from the stands and what it was like for people around the ballpark and what it was like, just what the atmosphere was like. Try to put you in there, because you're right. Everything that we could find about that game was, that's what everybody talked about, was the atmosphere was like. And like, I mean, it was greater even than Big Red Machine stuff. I mean, it was just something in the air that night.
Yep. I've still got my You Were There certificate.
Really? Is that right?
And my ticket stub. Yeah. From that night.
Yeah. So what you're telling me is it was like that. It was.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I've been to some big games, you know, big Reds games. I've never been to the clincher for the World Series or anything like that. But I was there when they clinched the playoffs, and I didn't get the feeling of the same level of excitement. And maybe it was just because it had been down so badly, you know, from the depths to the heights, you know, coming off, you know, so many bad years, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of those years is one of the only times this team lost 100 games. And if you look at the rosters from those years, you see why they lost so many games.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But, yeah, I've never been anywhere in any kind of sporting event where I had that same feeling.
Well, you know,
that day.
It wasn't just you. You know, we had just right. to watch the television broadcast, and you know, the broadcasters were like just buzzing. I mean, like it was something new. We had, you know, quotes from some of the players, like Dave Concepcion. He took off running out onto the field, and they're like, "What are you doing? Why are you?" He's like, "I don't want to get fined by my new manager. I got to get out there and I got to do better. I got to make sure I, you know, live up to what Pete expects of me." It was just the whole organization. Here's the quote from Concepcion. "I got to hustle now. If I don't, the manager will find me," said Concepcion. And the way that the other players reacted was just amazing. You know, they talked about how they had goosebumps, and that one of them was crying in the dugout during that time. So my favorite anecdote, though, that is in the book, I'm going to go ahead and tell it. My favorite one is this about 10 o'clock that night. The phone rang in the newsroom at the Cincinnati Inquirer, and someone said, "Hello, what's going on?" I said, I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I got this Cubs game on the Cubs cable station. The Reds were playing the Cubs that night, and I want to know what y'all are. Why are they running a rerun?" And the guy's like, "No, it's live. It's a live game." "Well, then what the blank is Pete Rose doing playing first base for the Reds?" And then they explained what had happened, and the guy just went nuts, and the people that was in his room in Portland, Oregon out there, they were all going nuts about what a great game it was. So those are the little stories that we tried to throw in when we could.
Another section I really enjoyed was the section on Eric Davis, maybe the biggest what if player that I, in Reds history.
That's one that Chris and I both absolutely knew had to be in, because he's a guy that's in our lifetimes been, like you said, it's a what if, but he was so good at his best. And the way we wanted to approach that was we took that 1 year, 1987, to talk about his whole life. But we wanted to give everybody an idea of the way that all around baseball, he was considered to be the best player around. I mean, everyone was in awe of him, kind of like what we talked about Yul Blackwell earlier. I don't think, after all the injuries and all this stuff, I'm not sure people can remember how much everybody in baseball, including Willie Mays, was Willie Mays said, "It's an honor for me to be compared to Eric Davis." You know, that's the way he was considered around there. So, again, that's a situation where it's a story that we didn't want people to forget. Eric. And of course, you know, you and I both remember Eric at his best, and he was. He was just, oh my goodness. Unspeakable how good he was, wasn't he?
The other thing that I enjoyed the sections on the 76 playoffs in the World Series, mainly because I didn't see those at the time.
Oh, really?
I was in boot camp. I was in the Navy.
That sounds like fun.
And, actually it was kind of fun because there were guys in my boot camp company that were both from Philly and from New York. And I took some money from them boys.
Excellent.
So that was always a good thing.
Yeah, definitely.
But, I enjoyed those sections too. The other section that's kind of offbeat that I thought was interesting was about the Stows and the Schwabs.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a different section. You know, it's kind of a different idea, but it's important to understand that the how they fit into the history of the Reds.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, they had way more impact on Reds baseball than anyone realizes. The Schwab family and the Stowe family. And it was actually Chris came up with the idea. And I hope we executed it well. But we wanted, again, that's a situation where we wanted, these are men that helped shape this franchise and make what it is. But they're going to be forgotten. They're going to be forgotten if we don't talk about them and sort of perpetuate the memory of these guys. And it was fun to research and write that chapter. Because, again, that's a story that I didn't know much of anything about. I mean, I knew Bernie Stowe. Everybody always talked about Bernie Stowe. But I didn't realize how deep those family's connections to the Reds went back to, you know, the early part of the century.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you liked it.
The guy that I was glad I saw got a pretty good mention in the 70 section on the 70 team, which was really my first. I started following baseball in probably 68 when I was like 10, you know, closely.
Yeah.
And I remember the 69 playoffs or the 69 season and the pennant race, and the Reds were in it down to the last week and ended up third. And then 70, you know, they just, you know, they fire Bristol and bring in Anderson, and they blew out the gate in 70. And the guy I was glad to see get some mention here is Wayne Simpson. Because he might be the second biggest what if.
Yeah.
And it was just another example. And I think you guys even say that somewhere. It was another example of how the Reds had no clue how to deal with young arms at the time.
Oh, my goodness. I mean,
between Nolan and Simpson.
Yeah.
Gary Nolan had to reinvent himself multiple times as a pitcher.
Right. It's Simpson's a guy that a lot of Reds fans don't know about, and that's why we did want to take a little bit of time to explore him. Because you're right. I mean, it's more so
He's 14-1 or 14-2 at the All-Star break?
Unhittable.
70.
He was unhittable.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the most dominant pitcher in the league. How many Reds fans know that? Not enough, I think, is what we decided. So.
And I had forgotten how badly their pitching staff had evaporated over the second half of that season.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was one of those seasons where they were very young and they ran into a really good pitching staff in the World Series. And Brooks Robinson was insane. You know, he was playing like he was from another planet.
Right.
And honestly, they got beat by a better team in 1970 in the World Series.
They did, but it's also an important team in Reds history. For what it was getting ready to launch.
Well, yeah, it was the big red machine taxiing down the runway.
Exactly, that's a good way to put it.
It's interesting. I mean, how things evolved. You know, talking about the big red machine. You know, if Tolan doesn't blow out his Achilles and play basketball in 71, do the Reds make the trade in 72 to bring in Morgan and Geronimo?
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
And then it's
all, how does that change the history of this ball club?
It's an entirely different book at that point.
Yeah. Well, it's probably an entirely different decade.
Yeah. Well, you know, we also talk in the book, one of the chapters is about the 1981 Reds, or 1980 Reds. the team that wasn't, that had the best, it was 81, yeah, the strike year. Best record in baseball. You know,
and it just won the division the year before.
They had won the division, I think, the 2 years before. No, maybe the year before that, they finished second.
79.
Yeah. But they had been competitive after the Big Red Machine, you know, 77, Tom Sawyer. I mean, they were competitive 77, 78, 79. And then this 1 year where they have the strike and the Reds have the best record in baseball but somehow don't make the playoffs. What if they do make the playoffs and win and add another World Series? Because there were still some significant pieces from the 75, 76 Reds there, mostly on the in the lineup. But, you know, maybe the Reds don't fall off a cliff the next few years. Maybe the sort of way we look at the Big Red Machine dynasty is extended out even further. If, you know, they got lucky in the playoffs one of those years, or had, you know, had actually made the playoffs and done something in the year that wasn't, the strike year. So I thought it was interesting to explore that team in the context of, and we tried to talk about it in the context of, this could have been a part of the Big Red Machine story. And it wasn't, but it's still an important story. We wanted to address it.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because you talk, you know, when you talk about the Big Red Machine, people generally close the book after the 76 World Series.
They do.
And you know, they were, like you said, they were competitive in 77, 78. They won the division in 79.
But even with the Tom Seaver chapter, where we talked about, we had about Tom Seaver's no-hitter, we wanted to talk about how, you know, they brought in Tom Seaver to the Big Red Machine. You know, it could have been a, even better, which is getting greedy maybe, but.
Did refresh my memory here. Did they go after wasn't that the same year they tried to get Vida Blue?
Wasn't Vida Blue? Oh, I can't remember.
Because that Vida, you know, the Vida Blue trade got.
Wasn't that the year before? Wait. Wasn't that 76 when they tried to get Vida Blue and it was voided
by
the league?
I thought it was 77, but I could be wrong. When Billy Kuhn waved off the deal.
Yeah, it was after that.
Trading for Dave Revering and cash, if I remember right.
Yeah. Oh, man, can you imagine? Yeah, and the league voided it. So, yeah, they may not have gone for Seaver had that actually happened.
Yeah.
But they did add Seaver and onto a really good team. Minus Tony Perez, that was really the big only piece from the Big Red Machine that wasn't there when they, I guess, in Don Gullett.
But, yeah.
What might have been?
Actually, somebody did a post on this on Red Leg Nation about Vida Blue coming to the Reds.
I'm sure of it, yeah.
I'm pulling it up now. On February 1st, 2016, somebody, John Ring wrote this. Mm-hmm. December of 77. So it would have been going into the 78 year.
Oh, is that right? Okay. I thought it was before that. Interesting. Hey, you can find whatever you want at redlegnation.com, man. We've been writing about the Reds. It's our 14th season.
Yep. And some of it's even true.
Some of it, not much, but some of it. Any other, before we wrap it up here, Bill, any other thoughts about the Big 50? Anything you think we got wrong? Anything you think we got right?
No, you know, like I said, there are sections that are, I don't know. Trivia isn't the right word, but like I said, you know, but there are things that you'll learn something in every chapter. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. I really, really did. The Marty and Joe chapter is really, really good. The Nasty Boys chapter is, you know, as much of an asshole as Rob Dibble really is from everybody I've ever talked to that's ever met the man. Unless you saw them, how good they were in 1990, you can't understand. You know, the game was over after six innings.
Yeah, it's just a nickname now, and we know they're legends. But yeah, when you were there, and then that's we talked about how the opponents looked at the Reds.
It's funny watching the Nationals the last couple of days. They've got a bullpen. I mean, they're not going to be as intimidating as those three guys were, but they've got three guys that are coming in 7, 8, 9. They're going to be pretty daggone tough also.
Yeah, yeah. But they're not the Nasty Boys.
No.
No one ever will be.
And none of those guys ever hit the height again that they did that year.
Yeah. I mean, they, you know, to various varying extents, they had good careers after that. But
oh, yeah.
But that was the year that all three of them were really just shut down pitchers, and it's true, especially in the playoffs, because, you know, Norm Charlton actually started a bunch of games that year.
Yeah, I think it was mostly in the second half of the season, if I remember right.
He did, but once you got the Nasty Boys back in the playoffs, it was six innings. Reds had the lead in six innings. It was over. You couldn't get to those guys. So, well, I do appreciate your kind words about the book, Bill, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. And, you know, I got a single tear streaming down my cheek now for all the nice things you've said.
Well, you know, don't count on it ever happening. Yeah.
Well, that's the first time and maybe the last. So, hey, thank you all for listening. You can subscribe to Red Leg Nation Radio wherever you subscribe to your podcast, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, whatever, wherever you get them, we'll be there. Leave us a rating and review. It really would mean a lot to me if you go out and were to get a copy at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or it's all local bookstores all over the region. I mean, it's not just Cincinnati. They're going to be in the bookstores all over. Buy a copy. I appreciate it. If you want me to sign it, we're going to be doing some book signings over the summer, spring and summer. Come out. Happy to sign it for you. And if that doesn't ruin the book for you. And if you go on Amazon and leave us a review, a five-star review, if you really like to give us a five-star review. If you didn't like it, maybe just keep that to yourself. But anyway, do appreciate everybody that's already bought it and read it and the great feedback we've gotten. It's pretty exciting, and I'm glad for once, Bill, I didn't let you down.
Well, it's a good way to get into this year's baseball season.
There you go. I guess so. So thanks for listening. This is Chad Dotson for Bill Lack saying so long, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Red Leg Nation Radio from RedLegNation.com. Subscribe to Red Leg Nation Radio on iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. And join us for discussion of all things Reds at RedLegNation.com. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.